Hey everyone, and welcome to Seriously Risky Business, the podcast we do here at Risky Biz HQ, which is of interest to people in policy. My name is Patrick Gray, and joining me as always is Tom Uren. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Patrick. How are you?
I am great. And yeah, we'd like to thank this week's sponsor, which is the enterprise browser maker, Island. And Tom actually recorded and published an interview with Island's CEO, Mike Fay, and that's in this podcast feed. And look, really, go listen to it. You did a great job on that one, Tom. I thought it was a really, really interesting interview. So people can check that one out. And also, we'd like to thank the Hewlett Foundation Cyber Initiative for supporting Tom's work with us here at Risky Biz. So, Tom, we've just been through the newsletter that you're about to publish, the Seriously Risky Biz newsletter. And you've taken a look at the nexus between human trafficking and the so-called pig butchering scams. And these are scams that have online dimensions and call center dimensions, but are really just fraud scams targeting individuals where they really try to just get all of their life savings out of them and stuff. It's a real scumbag crime, but it turns out there are multiple levels of scumbaggery involved here, because quite often the people who are doing these crimes are being forced to do them by, you know, criminal syndicates who are like quite literally trafficking them and holding them against their will and forcing them to do this.
Yeah, so pig butchering gets the name because they build a relationship over time, and it's kind of a Chinese phrase where you fatten the pig before you kill it and harvest it. And so I had thought that these scams were bad because they get so much money from people. Like, so they're long-term scams, there's a lot of investment, people lose hundreds of thousands of dollars. But it turns out, after reading this UN report from the High Commissioner for Refugees, it's like, oh, that's not even the worst part of it. The worst part is that the people who are actually carrying out the scams are literally sort of almost enslaved. So they're held against their will. They'll take their passport. They'll beat them. You know, there's stories about people getting basically killed if they try and escape. They'll even sell them on to other different types of human traffickers. So very, very nasty stuff. And yeah. There's this confluence around Myanmar, Cambodia, and to some extent the Philippines, Laos, and Thailand, where these syndicates operate. And part of the reason is that there's been a military coup in Myanmar, there's been a breakdown of law and order, a lot of corruption, not much rule of law, and since the pandemic, these groups have kind of just gone hell for leather building up an online scam operation, right?
The scale of this is just mind-boggling, right? So you've talked about a UN report, a new UN report that's come out that says at least 120,000 people across Myanmar and 100,000 in Cambodia are thought to be engaged in this stuff, you know, and they're being coerced into doing it. We saw, the first I heard of this was a few months back when we saw a bunch of people being rescued by authorities in the Philippines, initially 1,000 people and then another 2,700 people. And that's, you know, it turns out this wasn't the iceberg, right? This wasn't the whole iceberg. This was just really the tip of it. And it's, yeah, I mean, I think we need to reserve some space in the hole in the ground that I would like to put ransomware operators who target hospitals into, you know, like the people who are running these things. This is, as you say, it's even more awful than what happens to the victims of these pig butchering scams. It's just you know, there are so many victims involved here.
Yeah, that's right. The thing that, one of the things that struck me is that typically when you think of human trafficking, you think of less well-off people, poorly educated, who are tremendously vulnerable. In this case, they're actually targeting well-educated people. So they'll lure them to come, usually to travel, but not always, with, you know, promises of good jobs, good pay, bonuses, accommodation, food, and then they'll just intercept them at the airport or the, you know, whatever port they arrive at, take their passport, put them into essentially kind of camps, or I guess the other room for them is boiler rooms, or the other name for them is boiler rooms, and force them to do these scams.
Yeah, they're locking them in compounds, and if they're disobedient, they're being punished with things like gang rape. I mean, this is truly harrowing stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. Yeah, very terrible. I like these. Part of the reason I like working in this field is that usually you feel a bit divorced from human misery. You know, it's all about computers, and I think this is not like that at all. This is like truly terrible stuff. And I guess by taking well-educated people, they're really able to develop scripts for how these scams operate. So it's not a simple script. They work on them, they develop them, they build them out, they modify them over time. And so that there's really a, you know, it works. So they're talking about billions of dollars raised by these scams.
Yeah, and it's not flowing into the pockets of the people who are actually doing those crimes. It's flowing into the people who are coercing them, threatening their families with violence, organizing gang rape punishments and things. I mean, it is very, very depressing. I mean, I did find it interesting that, you know, where you arrived in your piece is that any incremental damage that we can do to this crime, this type of crime, is worth doing. Like, it's okay, solving the whole thing is going to be nigh on impossible. But everybody who can make a difference here should make a difference, because not only will you be preventing losses on the, you know, the victim from the victims of the scams, but you'll be perhaps scaling this down so that fewer people are effectively enslaved and forced to do this sort of stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you look at the whole thing in totality, it's not a very cybery crime, right? People are being held against their will by force. Like, that's not a cyber thing. However, there are key places...
It's what I'd describe as a internet-enabled crime, though.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So, yeah. Is it the supply and the demand side? They're reaching one set of victims through fraudulent advertisements. And those are often, you know, typically on social media. And so, you know, it might be on Facebook, might even be on Tinder, on Instagram. And so that's one kind of choke point where internet companies can make a difference. And the other place that they're reaching people is, you know, victims of the scam itself. They're also on social media. So I think there's places where these kinds of companies can do work that will make those scams less effective on both sides. And the point I make is, if you make a 10% difference, 10% fewer people, that doesn't sound like much, but you know, on the scale of that, that's tens of thousands of people potentially avoiding being trapped in these kinds of horrible crimes. And I think it's very easy when you look at it to say, well, this isn't a cyber problem. This is a government problem. This is a state problem. This is a UN problem. But I think, no, there's a lot that people can do. One point that the report makes is that people in Southeast Asia can be too trusting of what's on the internet, ironically. And so I think there's lots of steps people could take that would make, just publishing warnings.
Yeah, I mean, one interesting thing here is that a lot of the victims of these scams, a lot of the scam victims, tend to be in China, right? So the Chinese authorities are starting to take this seriously, to the point where they just staged a joint police operation with authorities in Myanmar to raid one of these places and arrest a bunch of people. And, you know, we all had a big smile on our dials at Risky Biz HQ when we read that the Chinese suspects who were detained in Myanmar were loaded onto buses and being sent back over the border into China. And, you know, we imagine that the punishment that awaits them will be grim and entirely appropriate.
Yeah, so it wasn't clear to me whether those 300 people were the actual syndicates or the people who are being forced to work. And it wouldn't be it wouldn't surprise me if there's this kind of triple tragedy occurring.
Where they wind up in prison for doing the crimes that they were forced to do. Oh, thanks,
that's
Tom.
Right.
Thanks. The one thing that we felt was kind of good in all of this, and you're saying it's probably just further victimization of trafficked people. Thank you.
The Philippines ones, they're very clear that they freed these people. Yep. So that is absolutely good news. And it's like you said at the beginning, thousands of people. But the report also makes it very clear that the people working these scams are victims as well. And it's very, it emphasizes that many times. So I think that's a legitimate concern. And I can see in Myanmar, it's like let's just lock up everyone here. Given that they're talking about 120,000 people, I think so far, you know, the reports Catalan found were added up to about 300 people. So it's literally a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Depends on which 300 people, though, and I guess that's kind of at the root of what we've just been talking about the last couple of minutes. You know, 300 ringleaders to be dropped into a large hole in China would be great. But yeah, unfortunately, if they're just...
Look, I'm cynical enough to believe that there's a lot of corruption and that the people who are really at the top are paying enough to be well protected, unfortunately.
Well, aren't you just a bucket of sunshine today, Tom Uren?
I've had a cold recently.
Yeah, so for anyone wondering why Tom sounds a bit different, he is recovering from a cold. Look, let's move on to our next item. And you've written a bit about age verification. So a federal judge in the United States has ruled that a Texas law that requires pornographic websites to implement age verification, a federal judge has ruled that that was unconstitutional and has blocked the law from being enacted. But this is a big topic in the United States. It's also a big topic in Australia. It seems that there's a lot of legislatures that are looking to implement these types of blocks, but obviously they're some issues involved with tying people's browsing activity to their age, which is usually something linked to their identity. So there are some big privacy issues here. What I did find interesting about the analysis you've done here is you looked at the some output from Australia's eSafety Office, which is thinking about this issue more in a roadmap sense than we're going to legislate something immediate or recommend immediate legislation and policy changes here sense. So why don't you just walk us through what the Australian eSafety Office, why don't you walk us through how they're thinking about this? Because I did find it interesting.
Yeah, they produced a roadmap back in March and I didn't notice it at the time. I thought it was a really good example of looking at a problem holistically and trying to figure out how do we want to get from where we are to a better place? And there's what I'd call easy solutions that are attractive, seem to address the problem, but when you dive deep into it, don't necessarily do that. And I think the age verification laws are probably a good example of that. So the eSafety Office did a tremendous amount of research. Like they've got a kind of almost 400-page report looking at the whole issue. They've kind of distilled that into a roadmap. And they did, they even went as far as to do background research into how children end up being exposed to pornography. And it's kind of very nuanced. So some of them, it's just accidental. Some seek them out. They look at what age is really of concern and why. And so they actually nailed down the reason we're concerned is because we think it may change children's attitudes to sex before they've grown up enough to have sensible discussions about it and sort of approach it maturely. And so that means that there's certain kids, you know, from 16 onwards. In Australia, you're legally allowed to have sex at that age. That's the age of consent, but you're still ironically banned from viewing pornography. And so that's a group where most people, they say, are less concerned about. But the key thing is that, well, one of the things I found interesting was that...
I think it's worth pointing out too, though, for people who might be based outside of Australia who think, wow, that's a crazy age of consent. I think that's the age of consent for people that age to have sex with people of about the same age.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, if someone in their 50s is you know, having a sexual relationship with a 16-year-old, that is still very much illegal.
Yeah, still not on. To me, those laws kind of make sense in the, you know, around the same age, fine. Vastly different ages, not right. But the one of the more interesting findings is that children often see pornography in just social media, group chats, it's chats with other people. And it's not just by going to those pornography sites. And so addressing pornography sites is one thing, but it's not necessarily like, you've got to look at the whole issue holistically, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, really where they seem to have been arriving is like, where they seem to have arrived is like, well, this isn't going to do as much as people think it is.
There's actually the risk that imposing it on particular sites,
imposing it on the mainstream adult websites is going to drive people to the websites that don't comply with the law, and they're probably going to be hosting much weirder content, shall we say.
Yeah, so they've got... I think that's a valid concern. Whether that stops you from doing anything, I think, is a different question. But really what they sort of decide at the end is that for young kids right now, the best approach is to have, you know, some combination of supervision, discussions with parents, filters, safety settings, parental controls, you know, stuff we already have right now. But that parents are often not educated on how to use them, don't know how to have those discussions. So it's not just a age verification technical band-aid that we need. It's a broader discussion in society, or a broader education in society. Now, that said, it also assessed different technologies for looking at age verification, from at one extreme presenting a government ID to another one, I guess, trying to guess your age from a photo. And it decided that all those technologies are not yet good enough. So the obvious risk with giving a government ID to a site is, well, what's going to happen to that?
Well, it's not just that. It's like, are you going to be able to then tie users' browsing activity on those sites to their real-world identity, which is, you know, probably not something most of the visitors of those websites would really want.
Yeah, and so the report does recognise those kind of risks and says that, look, you know, if you're an adult, porn is fine. Like, that's a thing we accept. They do think that some of the newer privacy-preserving age verification technologies could work. And so those are ones where the service doesn't know who you are. They just know that you, you know, have a particular attribute, which is you're of the right age. But those haven't been well tested yet. And so it recommends, look, we should test all these different technologies and figure out which ones work.
Yeah, I mean, there are some interesting approaches to that. You know, you can kind of think about it like tokenization, right? Where you can hold a token that says, I am of age, that says nothing else, but is verifiable through a third party. So there's some stuff that can be done there, but it's still something that makes people feel a bit twitchy.
Yeah, and I think their thought there is that would be great, but it also probably should be applied on just social media as well. So mandating it for porn sites, you know, is one thing. But since a lot of the time kids are finding porn not on porn sites, it needs to be a broader thing.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I mean, that sounds to me like policymakers getting a little bit too excited to me. You know, when you're trying to really do widespread access control based on a single attribute, I don't know. I just think there's probably some, you know, there's probably a whole bunch of downsides there that we wouldn't even discover until we've done it, is my feeling. Yeah,
possibly.
Anyway, Tom, you're in. Always wonderful to chat to you, my friend. You know, you covered other stuff in the newsletter as well, including, you know, global surveillance companies using... Digicel in Fiji to access the global SS7 network and do horrible things. And yeah, you've got a bunch of other news in there as well. Always great to chat to you, my friend, and we'll do it all again next week. Thank you.
Thanks, Pat.